some reaction and analysis after the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Hadley Arkus of Amherst College.
He would find something good in people at odds with him, and he helped to create this aura of civility that built enormous respect for him, even among people on the other side.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese.
In terms of his integrity, he felt compelled to write as the law was, not as he wished it to be. And in that sense, he was observing the best qualities of our democratic republic.
Dr. Robert George of Princeton University.
The court has lost its most determined and outspoken defender of constitutional originalism, its most outspoken defender of the idea of constitutional fidelity.
And Terry Mattingly of Get Religion.
We currently have a 5-4 division in the Supreme Court on everything that Scalia himself said is connected to the court having assumed a super legislative role in American life.
Your comprehensive source for news, information, and truth, issues, etc.
You mentioned, you've talked about Carl Icahn and other people you might want in your administration. Is there someone out there today who you say isn't on the court, but say this is the kind of person I would consider for the court?
Well, I don't want to mention names. I think it's inappropriate to mention names, and certainly at this stage, where, you know, it's so early, and we have a long
sister?
Way to go. My sister's great. I have a sister who's on the Court of Appeals, and she's fantastic.
Would she be a good Supreme Court justice?
I think she would be phenomenal. I think she'd be one of the best.
That's GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump speaking with Mark Halperin of Bloomberg News about Supreme Court candidates, stating that his pro-choice sister, a federal judge, would make a phenomenal Supreme Court candidate. Now, he has since said that he was speaking off the cuff and joking. He wasn't being serious there. But what would a Trump presidency mean for the Supreme Court? The Supreme Court is obviously in play. And then, with the death of Antonin Scalia recently, is it even more so in play? Has something changed there? We're going to be talking about GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump and the Supreme Court. Howard Slug will join us. He's an attorney in Washington, D.C. A little bit later, it's Christ in the Old Testament. Today, Jeremiah 26, Jeremiah threatened with death. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest. Now, you can join us for the next hour with questions or comments. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. Joining us to talk about GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump and the Supreme Court, Howard Slug. He's an attorney in Washington, D.C. He's authored a recent column for The Federalist titled A Vote for Trump is a Vote for Roe v. Wade. Howard, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote your piece shortly before the sudden death of Justice Scalia. How has his death, if any, in any way, changed your conclusions about a future presidency of Donald Trump and the Supreme Court?
Justice Scalia's unfortunate death, I think, very much heightened my concerns. When I wrote the article, we merely thought there was a possibility that the next president would get to replace one of the Supreme Court justices and tilt the court in either of the two favors. Now we know it's a certainty that Justice Scalia is going to be replaced, and there's even less room for error than there was previously.
How do you respond to someone who says, look, you know, you're right, a vote for Trump is a vote for Roe v. Wade. You're overstating your case. How do you respond?
I simply don't think that's the case. The Supreme Court has, all the more so after Obergefell, the recent gay marriage case, become the arbiter of our rights, at least in the view of the non-originalist members of the court. And in Obergefell, Justice Kennedy wrote that judges should use their own reasoned judgment rather than the text of the Constitution to decide what rights are included in the Constitution. With that precedent, the notion that the Supreme Court is going to expand and expand and expand rights like Roe versus Wade is self-evident. And if we get Donald Trump, a president who I think is very likely, first, I think very likely to lose to Hillary Clinton and allow her to put non-originalists on the courts, but second, likely himself to put non-originalists on the courts, I think they would take full advantage of the power that the court claimed in Obergefell.
So how would you describe Trump's views on the judiciary?
I think one of the examples that's really paradigmatic of it is that Donald Trump said that Kelo, the case in which the Supreme Court decided that the takings clause of the Constitution allows the government to take private property from one party, from one private party and give it to another private party, was 100% correct. That case is an anathema to originalists. In fact, when Donald Trump defends eminent domain, he always does it by discussing all the benefits. It adds jobs. There's all of these positive things that he sees there. That's what Justice Scalia would have called purposivism, and it's the opposite of originalism. My sense from hearing Donald Trump speak is that he's a purposivist.
And what exactly, how would you, in kind of layman's terms, describe that particular, in general, describe that particular approach to the judiciary?
Purposivism?
Yes.
It's an approach that looks at the outcomes and says, I think there will be a good outcome achieved if we have gay marriage or we have abortion or we have looser rules for eminent domain. Therefore, that's how I'm going to rule. I don't care what the statute says or what the Constitution says. I know what the outcome I want to have is, and I'm going to pursue that outcome.
So how would you respond to someone who says, well, Trump says that he's changed his position on abortion, so there's a better chance that he would be appointing a justice who would be of the originalist mindset? What would you say to that?
So I'd have two answers. The first is, I think that Trump being nominated is likely to give us a President Hillary Clinton, and she certainly would appoint non-originalists. But even if Trump were to win, and even if it were true that he had changed his spots and was going to attempt to nominate and usher through an originalist, the question is he going to stand on principle and make sure that person gets through, or is he going to compromise? He likes to brag about how he's great at making deals and how he's friends with Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi. Harry Reid is never going to make a deal that will put an originalist on the court. Harry Reid will make a deal that will put Justice Souter on the court. And if Donald Trump is not willing to stand on principle and fight for that originalist, and I think he would not be willing to do that, it doesn't matter if he has now become converted to originalism, he would be willing to spend political capital on it. And I think of our nominees, he's the least likely to be willing to fight that particular fight.
Now, give us the lay of the land of the court, if you would. Just how many potentially the next president, whoever he or she may end up being, how many potential vacancies could that president fill on the court?
I mean, unfortunately, Justice Scalia's death shows us that the potential is always nine. But realistically, there's going to be now, without Justice Scalia, five justices over 70 and three of them over 80. So somewhere between three and five is an unfortunately high possibility.
Why does the court matter?
As I mentioned earlier, especially after Obergefell, the court has the last word on, or at least has defined itself as having the last word. Certainly that's a debatable proposition, and I think the better argument is that they do not have the last word, but they act as if they have the last word, and most Americans accept it on our fundamental liberties. They decide a wide range of issues. Within the last few years, they've decided to properly interpret the Second Amendment to give us a right to bear arms, to improperly interpret some provision, which they didn't even mention what it was, of the Constitution to create a right to gay marriage. They've taken the question of abortion away from the American people and mandated that we allow abortion up until the ninth month of pregnancy. If the American people want to have the power to decide for themselves issues that they should decide for themselves and to have their actual rights in the Constitution honored, it's imperative to get originalists on the court. Because only an originalist is going to say, here are the things that the American people in 1790 decided should be taken out of a democratic process, and we're going to honor that. And conversely, here are the things they allowed to leave in the democratic process, and we're going to honor that as well.
And it's not just the Supreme Court. The lower courts are also in play here in even a more potentially kind of long-term sense. Talk about that.
Most decisions are finally decided by the appellate courts. You have to go through a district court at the beginning of every case, and you have an appeal as of right to an appellate court. The appellate courts can't decide not to hear your case. The Supreme Court, however, can decide not to hear your case and often does. Recently, a lot of Second Amendment cases have ended in the appellate courts because after McDonald, which was the second Supreme Court case on the Second Amendment that decided that states have a Second Amendment right, that members, citizens of states have a Second Amendment right against state governments, they have basically declined to take Second Amendment cases. So the final word has been with the appellate courts. And those courts, as you said, are very much in play. People retire or die, unfortunately, all the time and get replaced. And if those courts are in a bad state, the Supreme Court can only do so much. They only can hear, you know, 50 to 100 cases a year, and we're stuck with the decisions of those lower courts very often. And right now, with an 8-person court, a lot of cases are going to be 4-4, or at least some cases will be 4-4, and in those cases, the lower court decision stands.
How do you respond to someone who says, look, you know, presidents may be able to control the person that they appoint, and they vet them as carefully as they can, but there are often conservative presidents who have appointed justices who have turned out to be harmful to the conservative cause. And maybe the same works the other way. The president, whoever they may be, can't control the person once they're on the court. What's your response to that?
So from the conservative side, that's the argument for having the best possible person. It is difficult. And we have had presidents who have made mistakes. That's the argument for why the person who's selecting has to be the best, has to be the person with the most experience and the most principle, who's willing to say, I'm going to fight for the most conservative, most originalist judge I can find, and that will maximize our ability. Sure, it's not a guarantee, but certainly when we have something difficult, the choice is not, therefore, to pick the least qualified and least principled person. And in terms of the other side, in terms of the possibility of a liberal choosing a originalist judge, it almost never happens. We have to go back far into history to find examples of that occurring. They've just been very good at getting guys who support their sides.
Someone says, well, look, Howard, my vote for Donald Trump is really a protest. I'm kind of, you know, resigned to the fact that Hillary Clinton is going to be the Democratic nominee and that she's going to beat whoever we put up against her. So I'm just sending a message to the party and to Washington with my vote.
I think that person has miscalculated. They might be coming from good intentions, but I think they miscalculated. The Supreme Court is at stake, as we've discussed, and that is going to last for 30 or 40 years. If their calculation is, we're going to do a protest vote so that the GOP will get better in 2020 or even 2018, it'll very likely now, with Justice Scalia having unfortunately died, be too late to take back the Supreme Court, especially if President Hillary gets three or four Supreme Court nominees, and it's just a miscalculation to say, oh, it's worth it to throw this election or to elect a nominate a non-conservative in this election in the hope of making things better in the future.
Also talk, if you would, about how Roe itself isn't just any other court case. This isn't just any other right that we're talking about, even something as fundamental, as you said, as the Second Amendment. This is really an issue and a right of that is the right to life, that is of a grander caliber of the others that the court may entertain.
I guess I would address that two ways. First, on a legal principle, it's utterly baseless. The original Roe decision has no constitutional mooring whatsoever, and it was even further detached from the Constitution in the Casey decision, where the Supreme Court effectively admitted that the decision was wrong and still declined to overturn it. And from a moral and human perspective, you're right. I mean, it's a decision that effectively says, inherent in the American Constitution is the right to murder children, and the American people can do nothing about it. We can't go to other than amending the Constitution, which is very difficult, we can't go to our politicians. It's outside the democratic process that it is fundamental in the country's DNA that murdering children is the proper thing to do, or at least to have the option to murder children, and that really is an anathema. The notion that we are raising children and teaching them that inherent in our Constitution that our founders, knowingly or unknowingly, or whether it's in the emanation from penumbras, as non-originalists might say, there is a right to murder children is something we should not countenance.
How do you respond to Donald Trump's recent statement himself that his pro-choice sister, a federal judge, would herself make a phenomenal Supreme Court justice?
I think it shows where he stands. I think, to his credit, during the debate, he did mention two judges who might make very fine nominees, but it shows that he has no principles. A person who could in one breath say, I'm going to nominate real originalists, and in another breath say, I'm going to nominate my sister, who, as you said, authored a opinion in which she said that the anti-partial birth abortion law is unconstitutional, just shows he has no mooring. He'll say anything on any day, and that's too much of a risk for us to take when the Supreme Court is at stake.
Howard Slew is an attorney in Washington, D.C. He's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled Vote for Trump is a Vote for Roe v. Wade. You can read it under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Howard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we come back on this Thursday afternoon, Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer is going to join us. It's Christ in the Old Testament. We're going to turn to Jeremiah, known as this suffering, weeping prophet, threatened with death in Jeremiah 26, and we'll find Christ there as well. It's Thursday afternoon, February the 18th. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer joins us for the remainder of the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Are you looking for a quality Christian high school education in the Lutheran tradition? My name is Dr. Jay Krause, principal of Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, inviting you to our open house on Sunday, February 21st, from 1 to 3 in the afternoon here at our Edwardsville campus. You can meet faculty and staff, administration, students and parents, and find out more about our dynamic ministry. For more information, contact us at 618-656-0043, or check out our new website at melhs.org.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
God lays out for us in Scripture our need for salvation in the law and the assurance that Jesus has saved us in the gospel.
Dr. Carl Fakencher talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That's the way God communicates to us in every page of Scripture, and therefore it's vital that we have been given this gift of history, an understanding of law and gospel, make it a centerpiece in the way we speak law and gospel, the way we speak God's word to people today.
You can meet and hear Dr. Carl Fakencher making the case for law and gospel Friday, June 10th and Saturday, June 11th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2016 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.